energy. I'm always packing energy. Shall I pack a Diet Coke? Yeah.
Watch this.
Welcome back to the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. I am Tom Mills, and today I'm joined by Sam Williams. Sam, welcome.
Delighted to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for taking the time to come on our podcast this week.
It's a pleasure.
Out of a busy schedule.
And what a weekend of golf it's been. What have we got in store today, Thomas?
Well, I think to top and tail it, we're going to be talking about the Solheim Cup and the FedEx and what event it was or non-event it was, and then touch on the European Tour as well as they finish their penultimate event before they start to make solidify their picks for the Ryder Cup. So there was lots
Marcus
going on.
Smone
there was lots
well.
Of golf.
Yeah. All sort of around Ryder Cup and match
and
play.
Raducanu and Raducanu getting in the quarterfinals of the US Open tennis. I mean, it's all going on, isn't it?
We're not going to be talking about that. So
okay.
Don't even go there.
Let's talk about the only thing that really mattered.
World Championships.
No. That was pretty much a non-event. Let's not go there. We'll talk about that in a bit. But the thing that was really a breakthrough, again, Solheim Cup, amazing. Match play at its finest once more.
Incredible event. Absolutely incredible event, I thought.
I think a very good decision from sort of from the Solheim Cup to shift it a day, which I think is sensible, although I don't think they needed it because I think they could have gone toe-to-toe with the PGA and I think they would have won. But they decided to shift it a little bit just to make sure they weren't coinciding with the final day of the FedEx. But a sensible decision because it means you could just lock in on Monday and just go for it.
Yeah, and I don't think it's like ordained by, you know, the founding fathers of golf that tournaments must close on a Sunday. I think it's just, you know, let's face it, it's just broadcasting, isn't it? And I guess, yeah, moving it to a Monday was nice. It moved a weekend of golf into 5 days, which, you know, made my wife absolutely delirious when that was on the TV all weekend. But yeah, I mean, could it have gone toe to toe with the PGA? Absolutely. And it would have got better ratings, I'm sure. But yeah, it was quite nice having that on the Monday, so you could just kind of double down and focus on it. But I just couldn't tear myself away from it. I thought it was awesome. I thought the venue was quality. I thought, you know, you could tell, despite it being massively one-sided, there was a great vibe there, great atmosphere. And
yeah,
it's just a thing that crops up on the pod, isn't it? I think over and over is, you know, me and Bruce talking about it down at Burnham, you know, the how much fun it is just playing kind of match play golf. And then when you're watching, you know, the epitome of match play golf, but, you know, Solheim Cup being played over 3 days, 5 sessions. And it's just absolutely gripping stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there were some particularly standout performances, weren't there? I mean, from both sides, I think we have to start really with the most controversial.
No. We can't start with that. I don't think we can start with that. I think we've got to start with the result. So let me just push back on that. I looked at that result of, because we will come to the, you know, ball gate or whatever we're going to call it. But when you were watching that on the Monday, and we're looking at a scoreline now, 15-13, clearly 14.5 is the number you've got to get to. Was it me? I thought we were going to be so much clearer of 15 points. It was untrue.
Well, when they put up the projected rankings, you know, like when the first out of the gate were through like 14 holes, I think the projected score was something like 19-6 or something stupid. Like it was, I mean,
they'd started at 7, but no, it was like 17.5-18 was definitely,
yeah, it was a big smashing. And then the sort of tail end of the States team just turned up.
Yeah, I think like Altamare flipped the Siganda game, didn't she? I think Charlie Hull was I think she was in the lead.
She was
against
up. She was
Jessica Corder.
Yeah,
the whole thing all of a sudden started to get a little bit tense, I thought. Yeah. Which was actually great viewing, to be fair, but I was starting to get a little bit nervous. I think, you know, Mel Reid, absolutely remarkable. She managed to make that thing go down the 17th or wherever it went to.
And she had a putt for half as well. And, you know, like a probably 6 to 8 foot or something for half. And you're thinking it would have been mint for her to hold it. But I mean, she's such a competitor, isn't she? And I mean, that putt at the end by Castrum was absolutely clutch, wasn't it? We were texting on going like, you know, this is going to go down the wire. This is beyond Kang and Pedersen. But when she was in the bunker on the approach on 18,
I didn't think she had a chance again. That thing
just looked like, yeah, no chance. And then it was
great,
Dottie Pepper,
great escape. Yeah,
Dottie Pepper's like, oh, she's like 109th on the tour on sand saves, and you're like, oh god, this is a
definitely commentating for the wrong side. I thought a weekend she was clearly supporting her home nation, and not surprisingly, but
I mean the Europeans are hardly, you know.
No, but I mean, it shows the importance of a hot start in this, not just in the singles, mm-hmm. like getting up early, like that's got to put a lot of confidence in the players behind. But, you know, starting well on the foursomes on the Saturday, like that was, you know, how important were those points? Mm-hmm. You know, coming out the gate, taking 3.5 points from that first session was, you know, absolutely clutch, wasn't it? They all go down 18 from memory. Absolutely incredible stuff. I thought it was
only one of the four ball in the first morning didn't go down 18. I mean, it was absolutely, it was so tight. And if you look at the world rankings of everybody involved, I know I need to pull this up in front of me. You've got two teams that on paper, I mean, the USA should have absolutely smashed it. I mean, they had the world number one. Their average ranking was 26. So you've only got 12 players. That's pretty high. Yeah. You know, the highest ranked player in the European team was Nordqvist at 15. And the average ranking of the European team was 43 or 44. So,
and you've got players like Leo Maguire coming in without you know, any real form at that kind of level. You know, someone who's in the ascendancy, granted.
And interestingly, the Europeans always get, you know, this sort of stigma, I suppose, for being good in the foursomes and maybe not in the four balls, perhaps to do with the world rankings. But actually, across the whole 3 days, over the foursomes, they were one by one. And the four balls also, they won by one, which is not traditionally the European strong point.
I thought they were really unlucky on the Sunday morning because, you know, it was kind of like, it looked like it was going the same way as the Saturday foursomes did not on Sunday because they were a good fistful clear. Like, I think through nine, I think we were up in three games. I thought, you know, this is, you know, we could be like coming into Monday here needing just like, you know, 3 or 4 points here to get it done. Clearly that didn't happen, but no, it was amazing. Who stood out for you, Thomas, in terms of players?
I mean, Reed and Maguire. Maguire was very good, wasn't she? She was holing from absolutely everywhere, and it must have been tough. I think she's world number 43, so just broken into the top 50 in the world. It must have been a tough arena for her to go to, and a rookie in the Solheim Cup, and also in an away Solheim Cup with no fans whatsoever. It must have been a fairly daunting experience. And absolutely, she just seemed like she just lashed it up and was like, yeah, let's go for it. Oh, Austin Ernst is another one that I thought was like, yeah, just bring it on. I want it all. I just want to fight everybody.
Yeah, I mean, there were some of the individual performances were of a different order. I mean, granted, Leona Maguire basically putted her eyes out, didn't she, for 2 days? Mm. And then just played world-class golf on Sunday. Mm. I mean, how good, like how competitive does Mel Reid look as well? She's just like a dog with a bone. I also thought Al Tamari, I watched her quite a bit and I was like, you know, she literally looks like she's going to hole anything she looks at.
And Salas is just like, you just, every time Salas is over a putt, you just think it's going in. Yeah. Like from absolutely everywhere.
I mean, yeah. And you mentioned there about the crowds. I think, you know, that's definitely a factor that is going to be, it's definitely something the European side are going to have to contend with. The Whistling Straits, it's going to be the same thing. It'll be louder. You know, they're there. And I think there was a fairly astute observation in the commentary over the weekend that basically said Europeans are doing a really good job here of letting the Americans know they're there. Like if they knock a 12-footer in for birdie, like they'll walk in, they'll get it. Might be a little bit of kind of fist bumping with a partner. but there's no grandstanding. There's none of that kind of like index finger on the lip stuff, you know. There's none of this like,
yeah, it wasn't
huge sort of
aggressive,
like,
yeah.
Nah, exactly. And I think in many ways that stops them kind of rooting heavily against you. I don't know whether there's a little bit in there for the Ryder Cup team to take away, I think, perhaps, in terms of not playing to the crowd too much, because they just seem to go about their business quietly and, you know, all look very assured. They didn't look like there was any kind of flamboyance to what they were doing. It was just like, just go about what we're doing quietly. Let's just keep rolling putts and keep getting points on the board.
It was a very impressive performance all around, but we do need to touch on one of the more controversial. I mean, speaking about Nelly Korda, before we get on to the controversial thing, and it was nothing to do with Nelly Korda, by the way, apart from the fact that she hit the putt. In the talk us through the ruling in the morning. Talk us through what happened and what it led to. And I mean, it was just an insane thing that happened, really.
Yeah. So she, you know, 13th green. I think the match is tied at this point. There's absolutely nothing in it, and I want to say the putt's maybe 20 feet or so,
for eagle.
Right to left. Yeah, for eagle. Sorry. She put a great roll on it, but there's no way in hell that thing's going in the hole. It's one of those that's, you know, it's finished on the edge. Like, yeah, it's finished on the edge of the hole. It's unlucky. The ball could have dropped in, but it's definitely not one of those putts where you think it's teetering. And if you just stand there for a minute, like, okay, it might drop. It was none of that. And then what I thought was absolutely incredible, I think there's, you know, on balance, I think maybe everyone's partly culpable here, I think, to an extent. So Sagstrom walks over, grabs the ball, chucks it back. I would say swiftly. I wouldn't say like she rushed at it, but like, you know, she went and got the ball, she gave it back. They come off the green. And this sort of like, what is she like? Sort of about 4'8", this woman comes over, one of the rules officials, and just kind of starts waving her arms around and says, the ball's over the edge of the hole. You waited 7 seconds. You should have waited 10 seconds. So we're awarding the Team USA a 3. They're one up. And then she like turns to walk away, like kind of expecting Sagstrom just to go, okay, thanks for letting me know. Right, come on, guys, one down. And I was like, this is the most outrageous thing I've ever seen. And yeah, like, you know, clearly there's a bit of kind of protest going on. There's a bit of like, you know, people unsure. I think it's fair to say that it put a dampener on that session from then on in. It was pretty tough seeing Sagstrom in tears, you know, being interviewed afterwards. But I, you know, I don't buy this. I'm pretty sure that Nelly Korda could have intervened at that point.
First of all, in match play, perhaps this is because I don't know the rules, but I'm pretty sure I always understood like it was a player on player thing. You know, if you can call a player on a penalty, if that's what you want to do and get the rules official, but if it's not called or it's not made, no one should be stepping in. And let's get it straight.
I always see match players, it's between opposition. Like pretty much everything's agreed.
That ball was not going to go in. Like not on any planet was that ball going in.
And I don't see how, that's why I don't see how, you know, Nelly Korda couldn't have just said, look, to be fair, appreciate how it's looked. I was the closest to the ball. I'm pretty comfortable with the decision as we left it. Leave it. It's all square. Let's press on. She would escape from that as a bit of a hero, I think.
I don't think Nelly is in a position where she can do that. There's one thing like conceding a putt of 3 feet and being like, yeah, okay, that's given or whatever. That's one thing. To literally stand toe-to-toe with the rules official and lose essentially a hole in match play.
But it's not in the spirit of it, is it? That's where I'd push back, I think, here and say, okay, you know, in theory, yeah, I've been awarded a hole. If she felt it was the incorrect decision, you challenge it and you say, no, okay, got that that's the point. I'm saying that I'm comfortable that ball wasn't going to go in the hole. So
I am actually...
I definitely don't think it's in the spirit of it.
I personally think Sagstrom did approach that quickly. Now,
yeah, she moved.
I'm not accusing anybody
rapidly
of anything, but like, you know, in the same ilk that when you do like a putt on a quick green and it's on it's on a slope and it's stopped and you run up and mark it. It felt like that sort of thing. Like, oh shit, I bet, you know.
Kind of like when Phil Mickelson blasted a putt by at Shinnecock. That sort of speed.
And then he ran by and blasted it back. But you know, it's like I think it was too quick. That being said, it was never going in.
Yeah.
It was just, and it also felt like the rules officials, the rules officials just doubled down on it because then they were being interviewed by it. Like, come on, why don't you explain what this rule is? And they're just going, yeah, clearly hanging over the edge. We've looked at the video evidence. It was very, very clearly, 43% of the dimples were over the edge. And it's like, and what does that mean? So if you extrapolate this to an extreme, if you put a putt to a foot by, and I walk up to it with like after 5 seconds and pick it up and say, yeah,
well, that's what Katrina Matthews said. Yeah. That's like, exactly what she was like. So what happens on every putt, clearly that's not,
ridiculous.
Some people, knock it back when it's still moving, don't they? I mean, at the end of the, I'm sure they wouldn't go to that extent. Yeah. I just think that the other thing I'd take exception with this is I very rarely see a rules official intervene in any golf match on the TV that does the sport any favors. Like, no, I think every time you watch it, it brings it down a notch. Like, I mean, you've got to bear in mind that Solheim Cup's pretty, it's a great advert for women's golf, isn't it? It's definitely accessing a new audience. It's hopefully bringing more people into the game. People are going to be enthused watching this thinking, yeah, this is amazing. And then there's this random rule about 7 seconds when a ball's not moving. It's like, put that into context. So I have to wait 10 seconds to touch an object that's not moved for 10 seconds. It's like, just get your head around that outside of a golfing world. I think it's bizarre. I I'll admit, probably moved on the ball a bit quick, but for me, that's a decision between the players. I was amazed to see someone just put themselves in the middle of that. And particularly just wave these people on at the side of the greens like she was. It is a brilliant little exchange.
It was very, very bizarre. But I think, perhaps I'm biased, but I do think the better team won over the 3 days. And it was just truly a very, 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 very enjoyable thing to watch. It's not often I can sit there with golf without a phone or a tablet or a laptop and just watch. And I found myself, even though there wasn't a tremendous amount of golf on, because there's only, there was 12 matches on the Monday, but even when the four balls and the foursomes were on, there wasn't a huge amount of golf and there's a lot of waiting, but I could just sit there and watch it because it was just gripping.
You say that, it doesn't feel like that much, but it's pretty much the full East Lake team, full East Lake field, going toe-to-toe. It is quite a bit, actually. When you think most of the coverage, and that's why stroke play is just really hard to watch, I find, compared to that. Any form of match play golf is significantly more entertaining than 72
I'd probably
stroke
push
play.
Back on that, though, because, I enjoy watching this because there's a dynamic there that I'm not used to, which is players playing for each other. When I watch a match play with in the WGCs, I'm seeing pros sort of going at it.
Challenge accepted. But when they
are doing something which is, not for themselves, there is just suddenly a huge amount more interest for me. Watching players play 72-hole stroke play for money, I'm just losing interest. The FedEx. Not interested. It just seemed like it was, as you say, an exercise in spending money.
Exercise in handing out cash. One more quick take on Solheim as well before we move on. Inverness looked cool, really cool.
It looked funky, didn't it?
Yeah, I really like this first and tenth tee scenario. I don't know why. I had a massive penchant for that. I don't know why. I just thought it was cool. I thought it was great, circling back round to the same teeing ground and then playing off to the different sides. I thought there were some great, great golf holes there. I think Bubba Watson might have been kind of getting carried away with saying this is good enough to hold a US Open. And, I think if they put a bit of distance on there, I think there's talk of it. I always think it's amazing when, obviously, the course of Donald Ross, So that becomes the soundbite for any course commentaries. Like someone's drawn a diagram and said, if we're talking about anything to do with this course, it's got to be attributed back to Donald Ross. I'm like, I'm pretty sure this does not bear a massive resemblance to what Donald Ross laid out. Granted, the green sites, maybe some of the hole routings in the bunkering. But, I mean, the condition, you know, the severity of certain things, it's like, yeah, everything harks back to Donald Ross there. But the course did look superb, to be fair. It was a great setup.
I do think that, and I'd say this for most, I say most American courses, but this is pretty much only because I'm treated to this on Sky, which is usually American golf, is when you look at the super aerial views, the blimp views, they just look so parallel. You know,
there's not much variance, is there? No. Like triangulation or whatever.
We're not Tom Simpsoning here and having, you know, three hole triangulations and moving
elite
on.
Elite reference there, Tom. Very elite reference.
But it does seem like it did look like a cool course. I mean, it looked really interesting, and they had some, you know, pinch points in the fairways that were at the right distances and really challenging the players, and people were stepping up and just slotting driver into a 10-yard fairway, and that it was just really good. You know, it was very strategic, but from above it just looked
I think a lot of them look that. I mean, they
looked rubbish from the air as well.
I wonder what's going to happen in 20 years time when the next kind of look of American golf course architecture comes out, because square greens seem to be like on vogue at the moment, don't they? Like there's all these kind of like geometric shapes, everything's really square and angular, and it's a cool look, don't get me wrong, but it did work well. I think Jeff Shackelford kind of called out as well, you know, the running areas into the green make it really interesting. So, you know, seeing them play the running game, particularly out of the rough, you know, watching the ball release up there, the ground conditions were really firm. Everything was set up really for a great event. I thought it was, it was magnificent. So
I also, you know, talk about Donald Ross. One of Donald Ross's signatures is the upturn saucer greens. And I'm not entirely convinced they had a whole heap of that. They did have lots of run-ins into the greens. They also had a lot of runoffs. So there was, I think the 17th, where, you know, they had a lot of runoffs around the back and places where there were tightly mown areas that you could run off, and you would question, you know, can you chip off a tight lie, or can you putt from off the green? It was a good course. It looked like an enjoyable course. I'd like to, certainly more enjoyable than what we're faced with week in, week out on the PGA Tour.
Yeah. I guess kind of neat segue there to Eastlake. So Kays Valley was brilliant for, you know, watching people kind of get themselves into the championship, tour championship rather, you know, with all that, the exemptions and stuff. Just, I think it's fair to say that it's the nature of the beast, isn't it? You know, the week before, it's really tight. This time, two players run away with it. You could argue it's quite exciting watching them go toe-to-toe, but I just never find Eastlake a particularly exciting watch. I just don't. I mean, there's a couple of holes where there's some disaster looming, you know, the long par three, you know, there's lots of water. By the way, what a hole in one by Harris English there this week.
I know.
But yeah, I just couldn't get amped for it. And
I didn't find myself desperate to know what was going on, to be perfectly honest, in it. You know, I tuned in just to make sure that I was aware of what was going on, but just uninspiring. I mean, let's start with, it's the second year of trying this staggered start. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's good. Look, I mean, the moves there, isn't it, to, I think I might be wrong on this, but I think the decision to put it in, the last time it was played like that was, I'm pretty sure Justin Rose won. And you remember Tiger won the event. Justin Rose ended up walking away with FedEx. So all that kind of confusing stuff of like, you know,
Justin Rose,
Tiger's in the lead.
He's
Justin Rose
in the bunker,
is four back, but he's got to, he's got to finish T5 and everyone's moving around. The staggered start, it's an absolute finish. It's like you're watching scores. It's very clear to interpret who's going to win that. So I subscribe to it. I don't think it's an event with enormous amount of prestige. You know, really is just one huge paycheck for the guys. I mean, look, it depends what scores you get, doesn't it? I mean, best two players really on tour this year, got to the position of playing off for it. You know, you can't really argue with the results there.
I mean, but what they go away from, I suppose what they're trying to achieve is that essentially the whole year is a league, and they're playing a league like the Premier League, and the winners are the winners, but they're never going to do that because there's a competition at the end that can be won by anybody.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, when it comes to 30 blokes who are insanely rich, playing for money they don't need, and 25 of them can't win, it's like, it's just...
I mean, some of them can give it a run, can't they? Like Billy Horschel, I think, was giving it a good fist for a while.
But if you start, I mean, all these players are world class. If you start from five shots back, you need to have essentially, you need to, the guy who's leading needs to have a shocker, and you've got to have four of the best rounds of your life on the bounce. Yeah. Because they're all good enough. You can't give these guys a standing start.
No, I mean, you're right there. I'm sure they've done the numbers on this to try and work out, you know, representing value for being in the lead going into it, but equally keeping it interesting so it's not a complete victory lap. What I will say is Patrick Cantlay, absolute nails. I mean, I don't know if you caught any of his kind of post-third round interview where they were sort of saying, like, you know, how does it feel? You're sleeping on the lead at the FedEx here. You know, you kind of... You know, is it in your mind what you're going into tomorrow? Kind of what's on the line and stuff. And, you know, he just basically said, look, yeah, I go into a trance, I don't come out of it. And, you know, while I'm on the golf course, I'm just totally dialed on that. And you could see it. I mean, when he's one shot clear, he's got, I think, 212 into the 18th and just flags this, you know, six iron from you know, it looks like a tricky shot as well, because they always seem to have a little downhill lie.
Yeah.
Long irons off the downhill lie are not my friend. You know, that water would look huge to me in that case. But yeah, just absolute nails. Like they just don't make mistakes.
No, he's very, very good. Fair play to me. He has played the best golf of the playoffs without a shadow of a doubt. He has been the best golfer. But I mean, for me, it was, you know, congratulations, but.
No, special no shout out to Joaquin Niemann, though, who went out.
Yeah, tell me about this, because I think you told me by WhatsApp.
So I don't know the records, but he went out and played the final round in kind of one of those sprint finishes. Do you remember Sebastian Soderberg did one, I think?
Well, Kevin Na did one the other day, which is ironic because it's Kevin Na.
Just running everything in. Went out and played. I think he did it in 1 hour 58. His paycheck for that event is $405,000.
I know.
It's incredible.
There's some number, isn't it? Just to sprint round on your own.
So yeah, kind of special shout out for that. I thought there wasn't a huge amount else really to talk about from East Lake. I'd be really interested to see what go on then.
I'm going to propose a question to you about format in a moment. But first of all, I was watching the coverage, and it's like Sky Sports, and you're watching Rob Lee doing Rob Lee things. And he's standing there with Victor Hovland. No, he's just standing there with Victor Hovland. You know, and obviously the pretense, like Victor's got like a club in his hand and they're in the shots center or wherever they are, and he's, you know, the pretense is you're gonna hit some balls and stuff. And Rob Lee's going, what would it like to be win that 15 million, eh? What'd you do with that money? It's a lot of money, isn't it? And like, Hovland's like a bit cagey. Like, oh, you know. Well, I don't really know. Well, come on, you must have something. What would you buy with 15 million? And he's like, oh, you know, I just live in Ohio. I've got a good life. I don't really need anything. I mean, the dude's won like $6 million this year. He's not like he's struggling.
Yeah. He doesn't want for much, does he? It's not like he's going to clear the mortgage with this. Rob Lee just doesn't quite get it. I don't know what it is, but he just doesn't get it.
It was so strange. And it's like, I don't know whether it was a joke that perhaps I just didn't get, but it was like, it looked like Victor didn't get it either. And it's like, these guys, I mean, 15 million would help anybody. Don't get me wrong. I mean, no one's going to say no to 15 million, but it's for them. It's the reality is it's not life changing.
No.
They're going to accrue that in another year or two. It's just going to, that'll just is what they'll get. It's insane.
I mean, it's literally the difference between chartering a jet and owning one, isn't it? I mean, you're kind of lost in the rounding at this point.
In terms of the format, I mean, for me personally, I don't know how you feel about this, but if they didn't allow the top 125 to have automatic exemption to the PGA Tour next year. And they said maybe top 50 get automatic exemption. And then this last event of the year was a straight up 72 hole shootout for your card. For me, you know, with 150 players consistent at the Korn Ferry Tour, or maybe some Europeans, and the bottom 50 to 125 of the PGA Tour. And I'm watching these guys play for something that's not money, you know, it's something that's their livelihoods. Mm-hmm. For me, that would be so much better viewing than...
I think that, I mean, so that definitely exists, but you don't watch it, I would say. So Challenge Tour playoffs, do you watch it? Mallorca, usually, I think.
Do I have the option to watch it?
Yes.
On?
No, I don't think, you know, Sky do a great job of promoting it. It's usually a bit of a damp squib.
I accept that pushback.
But I know what you mean.
Pushback. But I'm heavily invested in the PGA Tour players for the entirety of the year. The people I know, the people I watch every week in, week out.
Yeah, but Hovland's not losing his card, is he?
No, I'm not saying he is, but maybe, you know, someone who came just outside the top 50 this year in the PGA. I'd have to look it up. But the people that I watch week in, week out, and to see those players fight for their card, for me, would be more interesting than watching a shootout between Cantlay and John Rahm.
See, I've got a good one for you here. Taylor Montgomery, Korn Ferry Tour player, qualified for the US Open, chose to play the US Open, went on, actually made the cut in the US Open, didn't play Korn Ferry Tour that weekend, ended up missing, came 126th, missed PGA Tour card by one position.
Mm. And because they don't count towards the Korn Ferry points, do they?
No. I mean, that's chronic. So I think, I suspect that if we were in the States, you would see a little bit more around the Korn Ferry Tour stuff and people getting the PGA Tour card. I saw Lucas Herbert picked up his card, like, you know, some good news stories there, but it did kind of wash a little under the radar, didn't it, this weekend? Mm.
But I suppose my point is that I'm just a tiny bit disenfranchised with people, you know, for what the FedEx was offering for me, not so much. I'd rather see them play for something more. And what's more than money is the, you know, the ability to make a living or team play, something team play, you know. I'm not, I know it's sort of frittered away, but I'm not a million miles off agreeing, starting to agree with the Premier Golf League's ideas of banding people together and representing teams and something more than themselves. I just don't feel like I'm engaging with the 72 stroke play like I want.
See, I feel golf, I mean, it's good as an individual sport most of the time. The fact remains that the PGA Tour, the European Tour, or, you know, all the professional tours out there are trying to create a 52 week a year product for people to enjoy. That needs significant investment. That needs multiple different formats, different types of events. It needs all sorts of stuff in there. You know, there's clearly got to be a season end, even though it goes all year, year round. We're back into it again after the Ryder Cup, or whatever. But, you know, look, it's there. It's always interesting. We had, you know, I think the Caves Valley was great, great fun, the BMW stuff. But yeah, I'm inclined to agree that I think a lot of people are starting to feel maybe with the FedEx finals that, you know, actually it's just an exercise in handing out money. Now, there is some people playing some stuff on the line this weekend. Absolutely. At Wentworth. So I do think this is going to be quite interesting. First off, Højgaard squared.
Squared. Yeah. Twin squared. Well, the Italian Open, did you manage to catch any of it? Because interestingly, the connection it has with what they're about to play for in the PGA is it's going to be the next Ryder Cup venue. And it looked okay. It looked, you know, Fazio design. It looked like it was a good course. There's some drivable par fours, some long par threes, short par threes. I think it's going to be, a good venue. But
yeah, I mean, yeah. It was, I didn't catch much of it. I think the golfing diet on the TV was pretty heavy last weekend. I didn't catch much of it, to be really honest.
There was some good golf.
Form those boys are bringing in at the moment. Like, I know they're too young. And yeah, I know they're too young, but you look at the I mean, you look at performances from people like Leona Maguire as a rookie in the Solheim Cup, and you just think, yeah, just take a gamble on it. But it does feel wild to bring Rasmus Højgaard into it, doesn't it? His bro would struggle for it unless you went with a double pairing. But I think you're wide open if you're Harrington.
I was going when we are planning a Ryder Cup podcast, and I've started to sort of compile what my picks would be. Rasmus was going to be, after he won last week, was going to be my sort of wild pick in there. He still had a good week, but yeah, I think he should be in it. I think
a win at Wentworth from anyone from Team Europe in that kind of 50 to 100 spot in the world would definitely be, I think so.
It's still so tight up there about who's... I mean, Fleetwood's had a good tied second, so he's had a good run out there, but it's
well, Fleetwood's going to be tight.
It's good to see him bringing form into it.
Yeah, definitely.
Because
he's
not the best form in the world, is he? But
we threw it open, didn't we? I mean, you know, bit of poll, always trying to sort of see what people's heads is at. And pretty much everyone put Garcia, Poulter, Rose. I just thought, that is just so safe. That just feels so safe.
Yeah.
Like, I just can't see that.
Garcia looks like he's played his way in, to be fair.
Without question.
Yeah, Garcia looks like he has, but it's going to be interesting to see who plays well this week. I mean, you've got people on the bubble like Bob Mack and Victor Perez and Biesberger. So it'll be interesting to see. This is it. They've just got to do it now. And after the Solheim Cup, I mean, I'm sure they'll be absolutely pumped to be involved. I mean, like, not like they weren't going to be already, but they're going to be absolutely amped to go out there, and hopefully it'll make the BMW PGA a better event.
Early Christmas present, Richard Bland winning at Wentworth, making it extremely difficult for Harrington then. How could you not put him in the Ryder Cup squad at that point? Led the US Open, 36-hole leader, won twice on the European Tour this year, demonstrating form. That, I just think that would be the ultimate. But yeah, we'll have to see how that plays out. Any other topical news, Thomas?
I suppose the only thing we haven't talked about that we possibly could is Patrick Reed and his sort of amnesia.
Oh, right. Okay. So I haven't followed this in detail. I've seen a few postmortems on it.
It's just like,
fill me in.
You know, he had his bilateral pneumonia and he's obviously back for that, for the FedEx. And then sort of in one news outlet, he reportedly said, yeah, had COVID, was close to dying. Okay. Did you get tested? Well, no, I didn't get tested, but you know, they tested me on the way out of hospital, and you're like, okay, so you were in there with breathing problems in the midst of a pandemic and no one tested you for COVID. No, no one tested me for COVID. I didn't have COVID actually. Now I think about it, I didn't have COVID.
No, it wasn't COVID. No.
It's just so bizarre. I mean, it's almost like he's thinking about the player impact program and he's thinking, well, I haven't really got anything to say. So if I just sort of make up a whirlwind of lies, that perhaps they'll talk about me and I might have some pip money at the end of the year. But
he's an incredible person. Incredible.
But he'll
individual.
Be in the right. You know, he's playing.
Yeah, well, he looks
right.
Like he's back, doesn't he? Get a bit of game time and under his belt between now and then. And
there was doubts whether he'd be healthy enough, but. I think the COVID
everyone had written
debated,
him off.
So.
I mean, you know, including us last week saying Patrick Reed, don't think he's going to be inside, bilateral pneumonia, you know, COVID, not counting hell's chance, and he's there at Eastlake, played okay. Yeah. You know,
I mean, he's obviously the Americans have got six picks. He's 11th or on that list of what they could pick. So if they just went top 12, he would be in. Whether they'll pick him, I think he's making it very difficult for himself to be picked.
Actually, Reed.
Yeah, but just by acting like such a maniac.
I wouldn't. I don't know. Get in the way of a pick from Captain Stricker. But yeah, I mean, exciting week just gone. Looking forward to the BMW. Cannot wait to see the final picks of the Ryder Cup. I'm getting seriously amped for that now. It's a couple of weeks away. And yeah, got a September's a busy month for the old golfing calendar. So looking forward to getting out there a bit.
Absolutely. Hopefully the weather will keep up and we can play a bit of golf, watch a bit of golf. And I mean, Lord knows we don't really play enough golf, do we, Sam?
No, I mean, we've taken, I think just on that, in terms of the films and stuff, obviously the end of the old Tom Morris series, taking a little break from filming, but we will be back releasing films in the not too distant future. So keep the eyes and
ears
peeled.
And until then, thank you for listening.
Adios.
Watch this. No way!